Well, good morning, and welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very interesting music we are listening to. That is Flor Laurentienne, the Canadian Instrumental Music Project, which is performing at the Zankel Music Center at Skidmore College in Saratoga. On November 8th, skidmore.edu/Zankel. And our playlist is posted at wamc.org/roundtable, and we would, you can always go there and find past shows at wamc.org. You can go find all of, if you want to download anything, but you can also find the playlist at wamc.org/roundtable. Good morning, all. Welcome. It is wonderful to have you here on this Tuesday morning. We are a week away. We are a week away from Election Day, and it is, I don't know how your days are going, but I would say the mood in this room is tense, and it usually isn't, but here we are, and we're all very, but we are excited to talk to you about what is going on. We have a wonderful group of people. Let me introduce them to you. And I think you will be impressed as I was when I looked and said, "Oh, these wonderful people are going to be on the show." Malia, do I know that is no. wrong? See, Malia's not here. That's right. No, Libby Post actually.
I am.
Malia called in, and I called Libby, and I said, "Can you be on the show?" And Libby said, "Yes," and that was this morning. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. I might sound like one of the guys. But
well, you're talking a lot higher.
Yeah, right. But
well,
I'm here.
You weren't here yesterday because you sounded worse than you do today.
Yeah.
And then, so glad you got to come in, and I thank you very much
thank
for being here.
Much.
It's really great to have you here. Jay Jochnowitz joins us, semi-retired editor at large, columnist, editorial writer at the Times Union. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, and to use my Monty Python voice, I've been bottling it up for a whole month.
Yeah, you wrote me a note during the fun drive. I was like, I'm just like
talking
like
to the cats.
Grousing to the cats. I don't know what to do here. Well, we're back, and after a wonderful fun drive, and here we are. And yesterday it felt good. I got back to my desk at the end of the show, and Sarah LaDuke, our producer, turned to me and said, "Well, that's good. We didn't forget how to do it." So that's
that's good.
I was like, "Yeah, that's good." Mike Spain joins us as well, former Times Union associate editor. And also the only person actually scheduled to be on today's show. So good morning to you, sir. It's very nice to,
well,
to
thank
have you with us.
It's really great to be here. And you mentioned the fun drive. I'll just say that congratulations. And it has got to be seen as a strong affirmation of the very good work that you all do here at WAMC. It's just, I'm glad it's over. I'm sure you are.
We are all glad it's
congratulations.
Over.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you very, very much, Mike, and thanks for all the help and the support from all of you during our special broadcasts and so forth, and I really appreciate it. We are. We have a lot to talk about. As I mentioned, just the election is 1 week from today, and so we are waiting to see what the next week will hold for us all. But I want to start with the story. We talked a little bit about the rally at Madison Square Garden, and. What I find interesting about this story is I know it's more of Trump being Trump, and it's more of the lies and the vulgarities and so forth that have become a staple of this campaign especially, but past campaigns as well. This one, though, the grand finale, if you will, at Madison Square Garden, was interesting because they actually addressed, like, oh, we are going to distance ourselves from this one person who said this one repugnant thing, which I thought was interesting because there were all those other repugnant things, and they were not distanced from that. Also, small thing, I know, but they did know what he was going to say, And yes. like he, they had read the script, so
they're claiming that he went off script for that one joke about Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
They're claiming that now,
yeah,
because the script was uploaded to the teleprompter, so they would have been able to vet it. And but getting away from that, Joe, they invited this comedian, knowing exactly the kind of dark, vicious, alleged humor that
yes.
he does. I mean, maybe you can go to a comedy club and be outrageous and get some people having drinks at an intimate situation, but you don't go before 20,000 people or the nation in this respect, because it's covered by extensively by the media, and say things like this fella said. And he didn't just say that one line about Puerto Rico.
No, no. And there were a number of yeah. things. And I had also heard that, and you're absolutely right, there's some debate over whether it was put into the teleprompter or not. But they did look at it, and there are people who are claiming that it was in the teleprompter, but also that not only that, but they had taken things out. One line where he actually referred to her as the C word,
yes.
and they took that out. So that's sort of the line they were looking at, I guess. And
the threshold.
The
yeah.
threshold, right. So, I thought that was interesting. The Trump campaign issuing a rare statement distancing itself from a comedian's offensive joke about Puerto Rico. This is just moments in campaign time, but a day after he said that he was going to win the Latino vote.
Mm-hmm.
And Donald Trump and his allies are full of bravado over his chances of victory in the closing days of the 2024 campaign, but there are signs publicly and privately that the former president and his team are worried that their opponents' descriptions of him as a racist and fascist may be breaking through to segments of voters. That anxiety was clear after Mr. Trump's six-hour event at Madison Square Garden in New York City, where the inflammatory speeches on Sunday included an opening act by a comedian known for a history of racist jokes, who derided Puerto Rico as a floating island of garbage and talked about black people carving watermelons. The backlash among Puerto Rican celebrities and performers was instantaneous across social media, prompting the Trump campaign to issue a rare defensive statement distancing themselves from the offensive comments. In a tight race, any constituency could be decisive, and the sizable Puerto Rican community in the battleground state of Pennsylvania was certainly on the minds of Trump allies. Before I throw it over to the panel, just a quick acknowledgement that the former president, as of yet, while the campaign has distanced itself from the remark, the former president himself, the candidate, has not, and has not said anything about it. Libby.
Well, he has a history of denigrating people of color. Yeah, I mean, we all know this man is a racist. He's a bigot. You can say whatever world you want that makes you happy, but he's a horrible human being who targets different groups of people. So no, he's not going to distance himself from this. I remember when he was throwing paper towels at people in Puerto Rico. Remember after after the hurricane. So, you know, his concern for their well-being is nil, and FEMA didn't do much to help other than the paper towels. They are distancing themselves because they know that this could really hurt them with the Latinx vote, which they were considering theirs. And so we'll see what happens in Pennsylvania and in these other swing states with sizable populations. But he's not going to say anything. But this guy also went after Jews. He went after blacks. I mean, he was an all offensive, took no prisoners kind of thing. But J.D. Vance called it, people can't take a joke. And it's like, what planet?
We are so politically correct in this right. country that we can't even
take a joke. What planet are you on when you don't see how offensive calling somebody's home state a floating garbage can is. How offensive can you be when you make a joke about blacks eating watermelons, you know, and Jews being cheap.
Carving watermelons for Halloween.
Right, yeah. And Jews being cheap or whatever it is he said about the Jewish community. I mean, this man, I remember when I was a student, Andrew Dice Clay was going to come to UAlbany. And the students got up in arms, the women mostly got up in arms, and they didn't bring him because he's so offensive. We've now become inured to this stuff because of Trump, and we have to take that back.
Yeah. You can still get him. He's out there available.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, go to his podcast. Go watch him online, you know, whatever.
Cheaper now, but yeah. Yes. Wow. Mike Spain.
Yeah, good points, Liz, Libby. It's exactly that. You know, it is the nature of the rhetoric right now to be brutal like that and expect to get away with it. And I think it backfired on them. They chose this comedian. They chose the other speakers. They chose Hulk Hogan, and they had Tucker Carlson get up there and make this ridiculous comment about. Kamala Harris being a Malaysian, Samoan, or whatever she is. I mean, these are deliberate attacks on people. Another speaker got up there and, talked about her pimped, how she's handled by pimps, suggesting she's a prostitute. It's an old trope, you know. And it isn't just this one comedian who said one thing about Puerto Rico. It was the lineup that they chose, they vetted, they put up there, and that is got to be seen as the level that the Trump campaign is operating.
It's like the greatest hits of vileness.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen Miller got up there and said America is for Americans, you know. I mean, it just wasn't one joke. This was reflective of what kind of person Trump is and what kind of campaign he's running.
I mean, Steve Bannon missed it by one day.
I know, he was still in jail. He got released from prison yesterday, and he couldn't make it Sunday.
But he will be doing his radio show today.
Great.
So there you go.
You know, the thing is that they chose to do this at Madison Square Garden, which has a history.
There was so much written about how Madison Square Garden was where a Nazi event was held in 1939 and all that. But FDR also spoke at Madison Square Garden. Bill Clinton, George Bush both accepted their nominations. It had a storied history. I wasn't following that. And then Sunday happened. And I'm saying, yeah, you're right.
Boom.
You know, I don't disagree with you, Libby, and that may certainly have played a part in the consideration. However, the article that I read that seemed to resonate with me, that just seems so Trump, is that wherever he is, he asks who sold out. And then he will then say, oh, well, I got more people than Elvis.
Right.
And I got more people than Frank Sinatra. So it was always about like the number of people that were in. And the fact that he had tried to play MSG, Madison Square Garden, for years, even in the last campaign, two campaigns, and the scheduling didn't work out. But that was always a place that he wanted to go because of, in this article, claiming that because of that, I wanted the crowd size.
It's always a size thing for him. Always.
He wanted to beat Billy Joel.
Yeah. It's not going to happen.
You know. Do it for 9 years and then see it. I want to hear from Mike. We're gonna just go through. We're gonna hear from Jay, and then we'll take a break right after that. Jay, you have as much time as you want. I don't want to take anything away from you. Go ahead.
Wonderful.
I know you've been bottling it up.
Yeah, I tend to agree with Mike that you know the choice of venue is a bit overdone. I pointed out in we were talking as an editorial board yesterday that before it was the German Bund, the big rally at the Garden was the one that actually didn't happen in real life. It was Brasilius Windrip from It Can't Happen Here held his final rally. This was the American fascist that Sinclair Lewis wrote about, held his final rally in New York. And it was mayhem after the rally. People were beaten up in the streets and so forth. And it really was the eve of the election, and it was telling you everything you needed to know was about to happen. And he was as reprehensible a character as Trump will ever be, I think. I agree with your point, Mike, that you choose your speakers at these highly scripted events. And I was trying to find a comparison, and I couldn't find a comparison that was as offensive as what happened there that wouldn't be that offensive for me to write on Facebook. Like I would offend all sorts of people, and I didn't even want to offend my friends in Alabama who have kind of lost friendship with over this election. Say it time and time again, and it's been written in more than one article. This is the kind of thing that would tank any other candidacy.
Absolutely.
And so that's what it comes down to. Nobody who supports Trump now is going to be offended by this. They might be a little discomforted by it, but it's not going to drive anybody away. So it's that narrow band of people. And I tend to think that if they're undecided at this point, this is not the thing that is going to tip them over, because it is hardly the worst thing we've ever happened. I go back to Charlottesville. We're going to hear when Trump finally gets around to thinking, maybe I need to say something about this. Maybe I need to distance myself from it. It's going to be, well, there were fine jokes on both sides, you know. he was very funny in many ways, and most of the jokes were very funny. But so he had one fall flat. Who hasn't had a joke fall flat? I've never.
You're channeling Donald Trump quite well.
The thing is that the joke didn't fall flat to the group. To the audience.
I wasn't there, but it did seem to his next comment after that joke was, "Okay, we're getting there." I don't think he got as big a laugh as he had hoped to get from. I think some people in the audience were concerned, but everybody's been concerned about Donald Trump. Joe, you look like a man who's about to say we need to take a break.
No, not at all. No, okay. Go ahead. No, I was giving the sign to Mike of that we have time to hear more from Jay.
Oh, good.
Which I think was... Okay.
Okay. Cool. Well, the only other thing was, my reaction was the same on Vance. Vance is, I think, he's an excellent choice of vice president for this guy. He was pitch perfect on speaking to the reporters. He was really speaking to the crowd about political correctness. That's what they want to reduce this whole thing to. You can't take a joke about Puerto Rico. You can't take a joke about blacks. You can't take a joke about Jews. Come on. You go to all sorts of, you love all sorts of comedians who tell all sorts of politically incorrect jokes. And so what's the problem? Well, the problem is that this is a president of future president of the United States. And you would not have let Kamala Harris get away with this. And nor should anyone have let Kamala Harris get away with this. But she would never do something like this. So here we are. Is it going to make a difference? I don't think it's going to make a difference. I think it's a lot of hot air.
Go ahead.
Puerto Ricans by state, right? 450,000 in Pennsylvania, swing state.
Yeah.
100,000 in North Carolina, possible swing because of Mark Robinson. 65,000 in Wisconsin, 50,000 in Michigan, 1.1 million in Florida. Now, are those all Puerto Ricans, or are some of them Cuban, right? Because the Cubans may not take offense at this, and they are usually further to the right because of Castro and what happened in 1958.
Well, the Democrats aren't going to win Florida.
Right. Well, I know, but some people are saying it might be in play. Who knows? But the thing is that it may move some of these other states.
Is this any... I realize this is a stretch. Is this any different than the song in, I was going to say My Fair Lady, West Side Story, three words, where the Puerto Rican characters sing a song about Puerto Rico, and it is incredibly demeaning for its time and for the standards of the time. Mm-hmm. And people who left Puerto Rico to come here. Now, people who are in Puerto Rico are probably going to take great offense, but they probably already long ago took great offense to Donald Trump. Are people who left Puerto Rico to come here going to feel any different than the fictional characters in that film about, or in the play, about Puerto Rico? Are they going to be that offended by it?
I think so. Everything that I keep saying is people are offended. You know, I've seen some clips.
Yeah.
People are offended. And that was, West Side Story was written by a nice white Jewish man.
That's true.
Right? In the 50s. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
It was a different time.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't see the new version, so I don't know if they changed any of the lyrics or anything like that. But, you know, it was a different time. It was over 50 years ago. It was close to 70 years ago, if not more. So, you know, our understanding, our ability to embrace other cultures is a lot different than it was back then. But these, in the play, Puerto Ricans are making fun of themselves or trashing themselves. Mm-hmm. It's like when I call myself a dyke, right? You can't call me a dyke, but I can call myself a dyke, right? And we see that in other groups as well, where people use a derogatory term that's sort of been normalized in a sense within that community. That's a lot different than a white guy getting up and saying Puerto Rico is a floating garbage can, right? And that blacks are carving watermelons for Halloween. Mm-hmm. It's a lot different.
Yeah.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Already a lot of letters. We'll get to as many as we can. Panel at keep them short, and we can get to as many as possible. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning, 1 week from Election Day. Just a reminder, we're going to have a post-Election Day special roundtable panel that will be taking place at the Linda. And, you know, how special it is will depend. But it'll be really cool, and we'll have a lot of people together, and we're looking forward to getting the gang all together, both the listeners and our panelists. And if we were talking about this during the fun drive, but if you did miss it, you can just go to WAMC.org and find out how to get to donate for tickets for that. And we would love to have you be in the audience with us for the event that will be 1 week from tomorrow from 9 to noon. But we talk about comedians and people on the docket there to speak before the former president came out and delivered his quote unquote closing message. But we're making a lot about a joke and a bad joke and a very vile joke, and rightfully so. However, also,
in other jokes,
in other speakers, Speaker Mike Johnson was taking in former President Donald Trump's grievance-fueled closing rally at Madison Square Garden on Sunday, when the main actor on stage turned to him and drew him into the drama. "I think with our little secret, we're going to do really well with the House, right?" Mr. Trump said, addressing Mr. Johnson directly. "Our little secret is having a big impact. He and I have a little secret. We will tell you what it is when the race is over."
If they really had a little secret, he wouldn't be so stupid to say it publicly like that.
I don't know about that. But I don't know. What does that mean? That's concerning,
that
right?
That they're going to fix the election. They're going to fix the January 6th.
But here's the confidential document I took from the White House. You're not supposed to see it. That's the kind of person he is. I don't doubt there's a little secret. But
to say it.
Yeah, he'd be foolish enough to say it. I agree with Jay that if he had some little secret, but it could be anything. It could be a secret about how they're going to, if the Republicans win the House, how they're going to handle the certification. It could be just some little secret about some little bomb in a couple of tight congressional races that is going to come out this week that'll shift secure control for the Republicans, and Johnson will stay Speaker, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's a whole lot of things, but just introducing it is a fun distraction that will tie up a lot of commentators and media like we're doing right now.
And get away from the jokes.
Yeah, and get away from whatever. I don't think he intended it to get away from the jokes. But, I mean, there's really literally less than a full week before this election is over. And, I mean, the last thing a candidate needs—
If you haven't already voted already.
Yeah. And I have already voted, so,
I have not.
For many people, they've
not.
Already
I
voted.
I like going to the voting booth. I like holding my wife's hand and going
into
the polls.
No, that's fair. That's fair. My wife and I had that discussion, but we just did it on Saturday.
We did it on Saturday. Same thing, my wife and I went. But the point, I guess, is you don't want to have Monday and now Tuesday again be talking about Madison Square Garden and the offensive jokes and the horrible things and the racist comments and the nationalist white nationalist comments that were made. That's not good for a campaign. Mm-hmm. And, you know, anything at all that detracts from that and sort of brings it back away from that is good for Trump. But, you know, there's not a lot of time left. It was a big mistake what happened on Sunday. And maybe the joke was intended to be a distraction, so we're not talking about Kamala Harris's own message. You know, we're talking about this. We're not talking about Kamala Harris, what she'll do as president, what her plan is, how. And I think that's been a deficit. I think people don't know enough about Kamala Harris. My fear is that we're going into the election where people know about Trump. They know all about Trump. They know whether they're going to like him or hate him, but they know all about Trump. And they say, but Harris, I just don't know what she'll do. The campaign's been short. I mean, this period has been short, and she hasn't been able to fully define herself to the public. That may hurt her. If we're talking about crazy little winks that Johnson has with Trump, we're not talking about what Harris would do as president, which we should.
I would like to move on to letters and to what Mike just discussed. I just want to read this these two paragraphs from the New York Times. In this case, the worst is very bad. It's a scenario in which Mr. Johnson, who worked with Mr. Trump to undermine the 2020 election results, would again be in cahoots with the former president to steal the election and stop the certification of the results of January 6th should Vice President Kamala Harris win. In a statement provided to the New York Times, the mild-mannered Mr. Johnson did nothing to alleviate those fears. Instead, he seemed to confirm that there was, in fact, a little secret, and that he planned to keep it that way. Mm-hmm. Mr. Johnson said, speaking of secrets, Harris knew Biden was physically and mentally impaired and kept it secret. The FBI knew that Hunter Biden's laptop was real and kept it secret. They also knew Russia collusion was fake and kept that secret, too. So that is the way that they are playing that particular secret.
It worked. Bringing up the little secret gave Johnson the prepared text that you just read that he said. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I tend to think, I've gone back and forth on this. And, you know, on the one hand, I think it, you know, especially when Trump ends it with, we're not going to tell you now, but we'll let you know later on. It feels like, here's my great health care plan. If I get elected, I'll tell you what it is. Here's my plan to end the war in Ukraine. Oh, wait, no. If I get elected, you'll find out what that is. And the same thing with the Middle East and the same thing with everything else.
Cliffhangers work, Jay.
Cliffhangers, you know, this is one of his trademarks. But at the same time, I would not be surprised if folks like John Eastman,
lawyer.
Yes, the scholar. Mark Levin, for all we know. You know, if a whole bunch of people have come up with a theory a legal theory of what Congress can and cannot do in regard to elections, and they're willing to push this with the to the Supreme Court and throw the election into some confusion and just roil the waters again if Trump loses. And of course, if he doesn't, it's going to be the perfect election. It was a great election.
Right.
I didn't get the popular vote, but that was because of all the fraud. Yeah. But other than that, it was a perfectly good election. Yeah. It's going to be that kind of nonsense either way.
I a little bit of history here. I remember in college when George McGovern was running against Nixon, there was a bumper sticker that said, "Remember October 9th." And it was a reference to October 9th, 1968, when Nixon was running against Humphrey. And he said, "I have a secret plan to end the Vietnam War." And anybody who doesn't, any candidate who's president, who becomes president and can't end this war in 4 years does not deserve to be reelected. So people wanted to remember October 9th. It didn't really turn the tables on Nixon, and he was reelected, as everyone knows, winning just about every single state, except Massachusetts. But it's a game that politicians play, and it requires people to have enormous trust in the person making that. And that just seems completely ridiculous in this situation.
Well, he's, and some people think he's Jesus.
Let's go to a couple of letters here. Carrie writes, "There's a lot of talk about how the Puerto Rico quote-unquote joke is going to affect the Puerto Rican vote, but I think it will have repercussions with many moderate undecided voters who won't want to be associated with such repulsive behavior."
That too.
I just don't know how many undecided voters, especially moderates, there are.
It may discourage people from actually voting.
Right. But correct. So that's the difference between an undecided voter of I'm going to vote for Harris versus Trump, or I'm going to vote or not.
Yeah, that's true. But who would most likely be a reluctant Trump voter who was going to do it and hold their nose, about the stink of it and vote for Trump, may not now vote for Trump, may just not vote or throw a vote away to somebody else or a vote away to a third party.
Gene writes to us and says, "By primarily focusing on the comedian, the media is giving cover to Trump. The mainstream media is largely ignoring the rest of the hate rally. They will let Trump off the hook after he throws the comedian under the bus." Mm-hmm. "However, this is a form of sane washing and normalizing what happened at Madison Square Garden. Giuliani said Palestinian toddlers are terrorists. Trump threatened Michelle Obama. A speaker called Harris the Antichrist. They demonized Democrats and immigrants. It was even worse, but I'm trying to keep this short."
He's correct.
Gene is absolutely correct. And I will say that not only that, but I was watching CNN coverage last night, and they were talking about the process, the meetings they had of what they could show. Like comments from the rally that they could show, and things that they deemed too offensive to show or to play, and I just think that's interesting too. But obviously, I think in watching, if you watch the coverage, most of what Gene just mentioned was included in the very unfortunate clip reel. Now, meanwhile, we have Marla, who says WAMC is no different than the rest of mainstream media and how much it talks about Trump. "Yesterday, a member of the panel was commenting on how little you hear about Harris in comparison and all her positive messages instead of Trump." I think Mike just said that, actually. "And all his negative messages. And then Joe started talking all about Trump again. It's really hard to hear about what our vice president is doing every day."
It's a really good point.
It is a really good point, except it makes it sound like I wanted to talk about that, which I don't. But I understand the point.
Yeah. It's impossible not. When I was driving in today, I was thinking I wanted to use the word dumb to describe the guy, because in so many ways he is. But when it comes to media, when it comes to marketing, when it comes to sucking all the air out of the room, he's a master at it. He is instinctively known this since the 1980s, how to be the center of attention. And there is, I don't know what it is, but you look at the guy and there is something you can't take your eyes off of.
Well, he also sells newspapers.
Yes.
He sells papers. He does.
Well, or you know? Airtime.
And airtime. Yeah. I mean, and you know, he sells journalistic real estate. Yeah. Let's put it that way. Yeah. And given the state of journalism these days, you know, I understand why he gets more coverage, because you need to sell the papers, you need to sell the ads.
Yeah. But it's also objectively appropriate to talk about how offensive this guy is. It feels uncomfortable, I think, for a lot of journalists, including opinion people like myself, to talk about Harris's plans because, A, it's kind of wonky, and, B, it sounds like you're almost advocating for her. And there's a difference between being critical and a difference between advocating in a journalistic mind, that – It's this is what we do. We talk about what's wrong, and we're not so good about talking about what's right.
Don't you think after 9 years,
yeah.
I mean, he came down the elevator stairs in 2015. But don't you think after 9 years, we still generally as a populace are still just can't believe what is being
yes.
said, and
yep.
and we can't process it, and people now other well, many people can. The polls show about 50%, but that you just can't process it. So he said this, and this, and it's 50 points, you know, and it's a neck and neck race. I think that fuels a lot of this. I understand, yeah. I understand the letter writer, but I also understand just sort of the trying to make sense. And you, one of you, I think it was you, Jay, said this earlier, like any other candidate mm-hmm. who said anything even close to this. Yeah. Would have been gone, you know. Howard Dean just screamed a city.
Right.
Name
All he did was go
and
yeah.
got kicked out.
Yeah.
It doesn't take much.
Yeah.
And here you have this litany of 9 years of stuff, including a presidency, that I still think people are just like, oh my God, really? That can still
how
happen?
Is this
how
possible?
Is this possible? And
yep.
I think that kind of it's like a magician, like a magic act. Like, how do you do that? Like, how does that work that there's a fascination with?
Yeah, it is astounding. And I think that sort of becomes the conversation. How is it tied at this point
mm-hmm.
when there is so much known about Donald Trump, his track record? The New York Times ran their editorial last week. You know, endorsing the presidency of Kamala Harris and the election of Kamala Harris. Well, Sunday they wrote a second editorial wrote a second editorial on the issue of Sunday. But the Times points out all the things that Trump has said and then all the reasons why you should believe exactly what he says.
Right.
This is not hyperbole. This is not bluster. This is exactly what he's planning to do. Listen to what he says. Do you really want that?
Well, it's even, I think it was Paul Begala who said, look, if Paul Begala or David Axelrod said, a lot of it is bluster. But if he does one of the things.
Mm-hmm. He's going to try to do a lot of them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, he's going to have a checklist.
Look,
he's going to have a checklist.
Punch
and
list.
Who of us are going to end up in jail because we're considered the enemies within?
All right, then we go to this. Nobody's talking about what I found to be the most rattling. Stephen Miller having images of brown people on the large screens asking, is this who you want to be your neighbors? I found this to be hideous and shocking for a presidential race. Absolutely. Also, I thought there was one more letter. I just want to find it here real quick.
Yeah, I don't think we... I think the collective, it's just so much has happened. I think we forget a lot of what happened in the Trump presidency. And, you know, I had a flash of it yesterday when I remembered time after time after time thinking, this is what they said they were going to do. And they're doing it. And there's nothing we can do about it. We can rant and we can rave and we can write editorials and we can hold, you know, people can hold protests in Washington, but there is nothing we can do about it. And it's going to be even more of that if he's elected, because the Supreme Court has decided that there's nothing, virtually nothing the president can do out of the White House that is prosecutable. So the only thing that's going to be left is a Congress where the open secret is that this Congress will never impeach this guy, no matter how bad he is. And the excuse, I was trying to think, what is the excuse they will use? If the courts aren't a recourse for this guy, then Congress is going to say, the logic out of Congress is going to be, if it's not a crime in the courts, if we can't prosecute him in the courts, we can't prosecute him in Congress.
That's the exact opposite of what impeachment is.
That's exactly
impeachment does not require it to be a crime.
Correct.
In the civil or in the criminal courts, it's up to Congress to decide what amounts to high crimes and misdemeanors.
But I would argue that is the logic we're going to hear out of this Congress if it comes down to that. If he's elected,
it's the opposite.
If this Congress maintains a Republican majority,
right?
And if they don't, which is quite possible, mm-hmm. then I think you'll see Trump being impeached again and again and again and again.
Or we won't see Trump ever again after this, and this will be the end of his career.
Which would be great.
Oh, I think you'll see him if he does not win the election.
Oh, he said he's not running again, though.
I know, but he's going to have to show up in court a lot of places.
Yeah, this is true.
So we'll leave before we go over to a news break with Ray. With this think question brought to us by listener Peter, who says, I can't help wondering if the Trump campaign was actually trying to lose the election, what would they do differently?
Boy, that's a good point.
Yeah. So good.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting point.
Yeah.
We'll think about that, and we'll let you think about that as well. We'll take a break and come back and talk about much more stuff after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 29th of October. We have Jay Jochnowitz, Mike Spain, and Libby Post with us, and we thank you all for being with us as well. We'll go back to the letters in just a little bit, but first, the Washington Post has been rocked by a tidal wave of cancellations from digital subscribers and a series of resignations from columnists, as the paper grapples with the fallout of owner Jeff Bezos' decision to block an endorsement of Vice President Kamala Harris for president. More than 200,000 people had canceled their digital subscriptions by midday Monday, according to two people at the paper with knowledge of internal matters. Not all cancellations take effect immediately. Still, the figure represents about 8% of the paper's paid circulation, roughly 2.5 million subscribers, which includes print as well. The number of cancellations continued to grow Monday afternoon. Corporate spokesperson declined to comment, citing the Washington Post's status as a privately held company. Meanwhile, former Post executive editor Marcus Brockley, is that how that's pronounced? Brockley? Yeah. Said it's a colossal number. The problem is people don't know why the decision was made. We basically know the decision was made, but we don't know what led to it. Chief executive and publisher Will Lewis on Friday explained the decision not to endorse in this year's presidential race or in future elections as a return to the Post's roots. It has for years styled itself as an independent paper. Few people inside the paper credit that rationale, given the timing. However, just days before a neck-and-neck race between Harris and former President Donald Trump. Former executive editor Marty Baron voiced that skepticism in an interview with Morning Edition on Monday. If this decision had been made 3 years ago, 2 years ago, maybe even a year ago, that would have been fine. It's certainly reasonable and to have that decision. But this was made within a couple weeks of the election, and there was no substantive, serious deliberation with the editorial board of the paper. It was clearly made for other reasons, not for reasons of high principle. Well, I have been waiting since Friday to have journalists in the room talking about this, so I am thrilled that I have. I'm not going to leave you out, Libby. No, but thrilled that I have both Mike and Jay here to talk about this. So, Mr. Editorial Boy, what do you what do you make of this?
I read Bezos' piece today. I guess he wrote it yesterday.
He put it out last night late.
There is so much to unpack on this. But what I'll focus on is I joined the Times Union editorial board and became an editorial writer in 2008. And one of the first things I got to do was go to a conference of the National Conference of Editorial Writers. It was then still a substantial organization that had been around since the 1940s. And it was everything you would think a gathering of opinion writers would be. It was lots of great talk and a lot of good booze and workshops and this was a prominent organization in its time. The State Department set aside a day for us to come and sit with their deputies and folks from the White House would come in and talk about various issues of the day and so forth. And when I came in, it was really the last hurrah. I happened to be chosen as the membership chairman sometime around the late aughts or the early teens, and was given the unenviable task of trying to salvage the membership at a time when two things were happening. The numbers of editorial writers and editors was dwindling, and the money to send people to conferences, which these conferences were enormously enlightening and enriching. That money was drying up. One of the big conversations was that people were starting to talk about the idea that they're going to drop endorsements. And one of three things has happened ever since. Either newspapers don't do endorsements at all because they don't want to alienate the readers. Beep. Or like the New York Times, they're not going to do local endorsements, or like the Washington Post. I don't know what the Post is going to do on local endorsements. They say, we're going to stay out of the national stuff, and we're only going to do the local things because that's where we think we can make a difference. So all that is just kind of setting the table for saying that I looked at Bezos's piece, and I give him some benefit of the doubt that he is as conflicted on this matter as any of us, and finally arrived at a conclusion that rather than say, here's what we're going to do in a race, here's the person we, in our best judgment, think is best qualified to be president, we're not going to alienate X percentage of our readership.
In that op-ed published in the Post, he did push back on suggestions that the decision was... He said it was his decision. He said clearly that acknowledged that it was his decision, but he pushed back saying it was not made with his business interest in mind, and was made, he says, to uphold the Post's reputation at a time when trust in media is eroding. Back to Marty Baron, who said, okay, but you're doing it 2 weeks before, or a week before the election. Right. And if you wanted to do this 3 years ago, or if you want to do it right after the election, fine. But to do it so close, it's hard to justify.
This should have been done a long time ago. This should not have been done on the eve of the election. And I'm trying not to dominate the conversation, but I just, there is a difference between editorial boards having an opinion and me as an individual having an opinion. It is a consensus arrived at by a group of people who have immersed themselves usually in an issue. In races, we've met with candidates, we've watched candidates for a whole lot longer than most people do, and what we're offering is here is as informed a judgment as we can. It is subjective. It is quote unquote biased in the sense that we are taking a position for something as opposed to against it, but it is we're asking you to just consider this because it's a very informed decision. And for him to throw that out the window right before an election when it is apparent to everyone, yes, maybe it's stating the obvious, maybe, but the timing was awful. Barron's absolutely right.
Jeff Bezos said, "I am not an ideal owner of
yeah, he did.
The Post."
correct.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, you know, this decision at this late point, and to underscore what you've just said, Jay, and what I guess what Marty Barron has said so eloquently.
Roundtable guest.
Right. Yes. Jay and I and you were on just a few weeks ago with Marty Barron talking a lot about this, where we talked about Jeff Bezos's role when Marty Barron was the editor, and he gives high marks and had given high marks and still does to the way that Bezos let the newsroom and the newspaper operate without any influence on their editorial positions. But to make this decision 10 days or whatever it is before the election, it amounts to a de facto editorial that says that Kamala Harris is no better than Donald Trump. It's to try to be neutral at a time of great crisis is you know, the coldest place in hell is reserved for that person. Didn't Dante say that?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's true. You can't. Bezos is right. He says in his piece that he released last night, it was very well written. I wonder who edited that for him. it says that an editorial from the Washington Post today endorsing Kamala Harris wouldn't change anyone's mind. Of course it wouldn't, but it's consistent with logical thinking, with righteousness, with where we should be if that is what they believe. And they absolutely, the editorial board believes that. They had the editorial researched and written.
And not to have an editorial, that yeah. does make a difference. It makes as much of a difference. I remember looking back on the 2016 election and I think on the 2020 election to see how many papers endorsed Trump and how many papers endorsed Biden and then before that Clinton. The fact that any endorsed Trump was enough for Trump to say, you see, I'm not as bad as you think I am. And some papers.
Las Vegas.
Yeah, Las Vegas.
Las Vegas was the only one in 16. I think there
Edelson,
are six.
Right?
Owned by Sheldon Adelson.
Edelson,
yeah. A big Trump backer. But six, I think, have endorsed him this year.
But to be silent, I would say they should change their motto. Democracy dies in silence.
The idea that this decision was not based on his own business, I have a bridge I'd like to sell you. Yeah. I mean, really. You know, he's got a multi-billion-dollar contract with the feds on the space travel stuff that he's doing. If Trump gets in, we all know that Trump tried to destroy Amazon and everything in 2016 and during his presidency. And I don't think he wants to see that again. And so, you know, Bezos is absolutely acting out of his own business interests as the sole owner of the Washington Post and the sole owner of these other businesses that he's got. And, oh, I didn't know they were meeting with, you know, he said they didn't know that those space folks were meeting with NASA.
I
mean, give me a break. I mean, you know, I'm sorry. I know it's big, but come on. You know, with everything that's going on, you didn't know that they were meeting with people from the government. I just don't buy any of it. And I, you know, there are times when I think editorial endorsements are helpful. Sometimes I think they don't matter at all. Sometimes I think they're great to have rather than having the opponent have it, right? I mean, that's really what it's about. It's better to have it than not. Whether it moves people, I'm not sure. But, I mean, I've used it very effectively in this cycle for Lee Kinlan because the TU endorsed him during the primary. You know, and so it's just, it's what we have come to expect from local journalism and papers like the Post and the New York Times. We've come to expect that they're going to make an endorsement because we've come to expect that these people are smart, look at the issues, read more than the average bear, right? Do the research and make an informed decision.
So let's go with your with that and say, okay, obviously he knew, and this was for business decisions, and he didn't want this. What? He obviously didn't want the backlash either. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what I don't understand. You know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's a newspaper that has Pinocchios, for goodness sakes, that has been fact-checking this president.
They've been tremendous in revealing the truth about
Have won Pulitzers as a result of it. My question is, what did he think was going to happen, and what did he think he was going to get out of it? Because this just doesn't seem to be worth it.
It gives, whether he intended this, it gives the Trump people the line. Even the Washington Post didn't endorse her. I mean, that can be very helpful to Trump and hurtful to Harris. And
when
I don't
think
he intended it, but I think that was the backlash that's going to happen.
I mean, this is the paper that brought down Nixon, right?
I know.
Watergate.
But they didn't
that.
Endorse back then, in all honesty.
I get that. Yeah. I understand that. But here
it wasn't
you have,
until after that.
Here's
that
the talking point. Here's the paper that brought down Richard Nixon not endorsing Kamala Harris from Trump's mouth. Right? So they must think
it's
I'm okay.
It's not a good look. I agree.
Right. They must think I'm okay because they got rid of Nixon, but they're not getting rid of me.
I'm sorry. Well, I was just going to say, and for different reasons, but let us also remember, and just for the listeners, that the LA Times also axed their endorsement as well.
I think what it does, and I think I tend to agree with Libby, you know, I say I give them the benefit of the doubt in one of my one of the arguments I have with myself, but I think it was a business decision, and I think that it simply sends a signal to Trump and all his people. We are ultimately, I am a transactional person just like you,
right?
And you don't have to worry if we go from Weimar Germany to the Nazi era. Don't worry. We remember Hitler didn't shut down. I don't think he shut down a whole lot of papers. They just went along with it.
Right.
And so did the corporate chiefs of the time,
that's called
titans
fascism,
of the time
Jay.
And stuff.
Right.
And this is this is the signal that Bezos sent. You know, and to lie in print, what's that? What's that to a person who doesn't understand journalism, who doesn't have it in his blood? All of what Marty Baron said about what Jeff Bezos did for the Post aside, I think ultimately Bezos said, I need to send a signal here, and this is the signal I'm sending.
Would this have happened had Harris in the polls in most of the swing states and in general have a 5 or 6 point lead?
Probably not.
It may have, but it would have been inconsequential. I think it's consequential now, unfortunately, for Harris.
Right.
Yeah, you know, just it's we're talking about spineless billionaires, maybe here. You know, big names, big money. Not
spineless billionaires.
Yeah, spineless billionaires.
500, 10,
whatever. And there was a good piece last week about how in the New York Times about how Jamie Dimon, who is the head of Citibank, is telling everybody that he talks to that he's terrified of Trump being president and how bad it would be for the economy and it's going to be a big mistake. He won't say that in public. Bill Gates, who never gets political and tries to avoid it, did come out and say it is bad for the people in order, you know, if Trump were to be president.
Well, Bloomberg just got around to it like in the last couple of days.
Well, I don't think there was much question that Bloomberg hadn't changed his mind since his speech at the 2016 convention.
We know a con man when we see one.
Yeah, I think
about
he's always
the money.
Been on the record as being anti-Trump. But
no, but as far as the money flow.
Yeah.
And that's okay. A $50 million infusion in the last week, I wouldn't mind it.
You're okay with that?
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
So maybe this was did any of you, but at any time did you think in the immediately after it was announced on Friday that the very simple announcement, not specific and the backstory, but we're just not going to endorse anymore, that at any point they would reverse course?
I think it's still possible that they
really.
I believe in the next week it is entirely possible. 200,000 people is a lot.
That was my next question. I mean, you're hemorrhaging now. I mean, that's.
It was already hemorrhaging, actually.
Oh no, I know.
I mean,
I know.
Yeah. I mean, it's more now, and that can to a businessman that can make a difference. I guess if it is totally transactional, as Jay and Libby have argued, you know, Bezos's approach to this. The transaction is with his readers now, but
then he would have had that opportunity last night in the piece.
Well,
that
he's
he
making
wrote
an
as
argument
opposed to
that he's yeah. I mean, but he,
right. But I mean, that would have been the time to turn if you're gonna.
Yeah, but
many
of their columnists, some of their columnists have quit. Some have quit the editorial board and are going to continue just to be opinion columnists. And I think it was Philip Bump wrote a good piece about why I'm not quitting the Washington Post. It's still a platform where. Mm-hmm. Much comes up.
Okay, so
and I didn't cancel my subscription because it just hurts the people who work there.
Yeah,
it doesn't hurt Jeff Bezos really. It hurts that now you can. Some people are saying cancel your Amazon Prime subscription, and that'll have more of an impact, and that's going to be more difficult for people to do.
Then you'll just pay to have stuff shipped.
Right.
To you.
Yeah. So I have 4 minutes and two questions. I mean, we'll have more time on the other side of the break. But number one, Jay, I ask you, and you alone this question. But would you have stepped down?
That is a really good question. Very possibly, if we had gotten to the point of writing a draft of an editorial, and then having the publisher, the owner. Step in and say, you can't do that. I'm at a point in my life where I could do that.
Right, you're semi-retired. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, and I probably would have stepped down at that point. And to Libby's point, no, I didn't cancel my subscription either because I think there's bigger issues here than just whether I'm pissed at the
You're okay. You're fine. You're all right with that.
Whether I'm a little mad about about this. The good work that they do, and I'm persuaded by the piece that is in the Atlantic, which I have not read yet, but I got the highlights of it. That you know, if you wanna send a message to Bezos, the better one is Amazon. But you know, then you're talking about being one of you know billions of people.
Right.
You know, it's hard to make that statement.
Also, and the other question before we go to a break is that I mean, I read the paper every day. I read the, as I think we all do in this room, read the Washington Post every day. That editorial page is still filled with anti-Trump editorials. I mean, it's not like...
Commentaries.
Opinion pieces. Yeah. Right. It's not as if they've stopped... This was an editorial board decision that they decided to endorse, and then that was pulled. Mm-hmm. But... Even that same editorial board, how long ago, had put out a piece that said that this is not the guy? He's not fit to run for president. Mm-hmm. He's not fit to be president.
Yeah.
So it's.
It's murky. Yeah, it is murky.
I
mean, the timing, as Marty Baron said, is the most important thing. It shows cowardice at this point. It just means you can't say everything that you have demonstrated you in. Where you are, you know, and sound like a broken record. I think it will be, unfortunately, it will come across to some people. Even the Post didn't endorse her,
right? And meanwhile, mm-hmm. you have the New York Times, in the print edition, although they did it online as well. Mm-hmm. But in the print edition,
he said,
"Boom, boom, boom." In what point type did?
Yeah, it was.
Did the newspaper people know?
18-point type. 24-point type.
Going down, and then said, "You know, believe him."
Yeah.
And that was the front page of the opinion. Now I have to wonder. I assume that was in the works prior to the decision, and not as a result of. In contrast to what happened on Friday with the Post,
we had actually had months of discussions about how we were going to do our editorial on this, and originally I had proposed a week long series where we went through the liar, the crook, the sexual predator, the bigot, the autocrat.
So you
waiting.
Weren't endorsing him, right?
Well, it wasn't going to be an endorsement.
What about his mental capacity? Was that one?
I don't think we got to that one.
just so many days in the week.
Eight days. Right. Yeah. 8 days.
And some months ago, we had said, you know, this could be. I said, look, if we want to have an impact, then devote a week to it. And that will, you know, that's the kind of thing that gets.
I got to take a break. But
okay.
Hold that point.
That's the kind of thing that gets.
Yes. I want you to finish that up right after this. All right. We gave you a moment to contemplate things. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. And you all right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Need another Wasson? All right. Libby Post is with us. We have Jay Jochnowitz and Mike Spain. And, of course, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. And we're so happy to have you all here. It's good to be back from Fun Drive and to wish we were yesterday as well. But great to have you all here and talk about the news of the day. So let's go. We have a lot of letters from people, and I want to get to some of the letters, but let's just do one more election story, and then we'll get going here as we wrap up our time together. And that story is about, and I just asked the group because I was wrestling with this a little bit of how a local story this was, but I do think it has ramifications, and I'm interested in what our panel makes of it. But the ballot drop boxes that were set on fire in Portland, Oregon, in the metro area, hundreds of ballots were destroyed at one drop box, and three were damaged at another. And these are votes that were, they burned up. And incendiary devices sparked fires early Monday in ballot boxes in Portland, resulting in those ballots being destroyed. Just outside of Portland and Vancouver, Washington reporters, excuse me, no, firefighters are the people who carry the hoses and put fires out, remove burning ballots from a drop box, according to video and photos from local press outlets, media outlets. The footage showed firefighters stamping out a smoldering pile of ballots that appeared to have been burned to ashes. So this obviously is something that's going to have to, whose ballot was in there, what options do they have going forward? There's the mechanics of all of that. I guess I want to ask a general question of what concerns come out of a story like this, and what does it tell us about the idea of ballot boxes, much like mailboxes, seem like a really good idea, but this can happen.
Yeah, I think that, obviously we worry about copycats. At this scale in Oregon and in the state of Washington where these two incidents happened, it may likely not have a difference. It make a difference. It might be a few hundred votes. In some cases, they emptied the ballot box every day, so they asked people who voted after a certain hour to come and get a new ballot. I don't know whether that would be valid, but that they're trying to mitigate this in Portland. That was in Washington. Over in Portland, across the river, they actually could read numbers on them, and they could contact people and invite them to vote over again and stuff like that. But the worry, what it says, Joe, is that our whole system is based on a trust. Mm-hmm. Our whole system is based on it's extraordinarily vulnerable. It's almost like a metaphor for our political system. You know, we think the democracy is rock solid, that it's got a hard shell that's going to be very hard to beat, and it will survive. And you know, it isn't. It's very vulnerable. If copycats came in and they went in big numbers in this one congressional district in the state of Washington where this happened, it was a very close race last time where a Democrat and a Republican are running again. The same two people are running against for a seat that it was a very close call last time. Any ballot may make a difference. And, I mean, if someone burned up 500 votes in the state of Florida in 2000, in the year 2000, that would have made the difference between Gore and Bush, and that would have flipped the election. So it's really scary that we're so vulnerable and that people want to throw throw bombs into things, throw hand grenades, or start fires that can make a big difference if it was on a larger scale. It's scary.
And don't take this as any approval or disapproval of the process, but I assume that somebody must have thought about the safety of the ballots when you put a box on a street corner of what possibly could happen to it.
Well, supposedly there was fire abatement stuff
in the Oregon box, the Oregon one.
And I think even in the Washington one, it just didn't work. And it is about trust. I mean, you know, all of our elections are about trust. We went yesterday, and Lynn took her pocketbook. And I said, "You don't need your ID, right? You don't in New York. You just need to sign, and that's it." And I think that I want to know who did this, right? I think that speaks volumes as in terms of who did it, and who that person supports. Because look, these are ballots in pretty progressive areas, right? Especially
Multnomah County.
Yeah, it's pretty progressive
Good
there.
Job, Mike.
And trying to destroy ballots that might have voted for Harris. So it's astounding to me that people are going to this kind of action to screw up the election and to make it seem like we can't trust the results.
I want to hear from Jay, but I don't want to in any way seem, this is just extremely anecdotal and I'm not fear-mongering here, or at least that is certainly not my intention. But I found it really interesting as I was standing in line and waiting to vote at the county center on Saturday, of people I was talking to, and I would generalize to the nth degree and say of both parties, of saying that the reason that they were there is they were concerned that something would happen at the polls on election day. And I thought that was really interesting. And so that... There already seems to be a little concern as to what, and we can call that media hype or whatever, the reasons that people feel that way. But again, anecdotally, it seems like people feel that way.
I having not voted early, I haven't experienced that, and it never even occurred to me that that would be part of the choice I'd be making between voting early or voting at the polls. But I live in a sweet little town. It's a very Republican town. There are, I think on the long strip of my street there are, which is goes from all the, from Altamont all the way to Gallupville in Schoharie. It's just one long street.
Wow. Gallupville, yes.
Are there any Trump signs?
Oh my God. There are two Harris signs in the whole, 10 miles of that stretch that I haven't gone over to Gallupville lately. But, it's all Trump signs. My neighbors across the street, my neighbor down the road, everybody.
I have no
concern about going to the poll. Because, it's the same people I've been going to the poll and seeing all these years.
Sure. And I think it's outside forces that they're worried about. Yeah. But I think that's interesting. And as Libby said, we don't know who it all was responsible for these particular incidents of whether they were local or not. But my wife did say to me as we were driving up and all of the Trump signs, but then there's like the big tractors and then the hay wagons and the flags. And she said, when does a sign become a shrine?
Yeah.
Like it's
that's
it's
a good question.
Like an altar,
And it's got to be 100 feet away.
Yeah. Well, right.
When, When an event like this happens, when someone torched these boxes, it's just one more acknowledgement that people are worried about the integrity of the election.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they never were to any extent before. And now it's been planted in our mind that I don't think the election was fixed. Maybe it was.
He's created this doubt.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Libby.
Trump has created this narrative
that people are, I mean, I don't think this will matter, but it might. You know, it's just scary. I just like you, Libby, I want to know who it is that did this, and that will tell a lot.
Which is why I didn't want to. That's a place I haven't let my mind go. Yes, they are progressive areas, but I said to myself, you know, it's entirely possible. You know, I'm not going to have a discussion about this with the editorial board, for example, because we don't know what we don't know.
Right.
And it could be, it could well be. I don't want to be a Fox News and jump to the conclusion that this is the Trump people or this. The bottom line of this is, can they recover the votes?
Right.
Either by pulling them out of the ashes or getting in touch with the voters. And if that is all done, then I don't want to say no harm, no foul, but that is the bottom line of what matters in the election. What's going to happen afterwards is, I guarantee you, if it's a Trump supporter, it'll be an exception to the rule as far as Fox and Newsmax and all these others are concerned. And it's entirely possible they will say it's a false flag.
Yeah.
The Democrats set up a person to be a Trump voter.
Right.
And you know, or it's just some lunatic and it's not what we are. If it's a Democrat, well, this is all Democrats. It is a violent political movement in America, and it's got to be stopped.
Right.
This is the narrative it's going to be, and I'm frustrated.
Yeah, I mean, and it should just be, we shouldn't do this. Like, we shouldn't burn. Can you, does anyone know, and I will readily admit a huge blind spot of my knowledge on this particular issue, and that is, what is the advantage of putting it in a ballot box as opposed to taking your absentee ballot and mailing it through the United States Postal Service?
I guess it's a tactile proof that it's actually there. One year I was going out of the town for election time, so I brought it to the Board of Elections and dropped it right there at the thing, and she said, thanks. You just know it's there and it's secure. And it's a custom, it's a cultural thing. In Washington and Oregon and other states, they all get mailed ballots and they all just fill them out and drop them off or send them in. And it's just the way it is. It's been that way for years, and it's not been a problem.
It's funny, too, because when Jay was talking about, you know, going to his polling place, but it's like, well, I went up to the county and I walked in and there's, you know, however many people, 25 people there working. And I'm like, oh, okay, so I know everyone in this room. And it feels like we're from all different backgrounds and political stripes, but I know everyone in this room, and
it's community.
And I trust everyone in this room. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not worried about what's going to happen in here because I know everybody here. But
and it's the lone wolf that people are afraid of. That's the thing. We're all going. All the workers are there. You know, in New York, you know, people are not being as badly harassed as they are in some other states. But people are concerned about the lone wolf who will come in with an AK-47 or an AR-15 and shoot the place up. I mean, that's what I think people are concerned with.
Well, President Trump is going to hold former President Trump. I apologize for all the people that bother are horrified when I say that. Former President Trump is having a news conference from Mar-a-Lago to clear up. Mm-hmm. The Madison Square Garden rally kerfuffle, and I'm sure that will be very clear at the end of that. And
sure,
I'm also sure that as a result, we'll probably have even more to talk about tomorrow.
It'll be the greatest word salad ever.
Yes, right.
The weave! the weave. Jay Jognowitz, Mike Spain, Libby Post, I love you all. Thank you so much for being here, and we will be back right after this.
So good to be